How much of your personal identifying data, like your fingerprint, eyeprint,
your iris,
or your palm of your hand, or your face, are you prepared to give up in the name of convenience? This data is all going somewhere.
Mark, hello, good morning.
Good morning, good morning. You know, increasingly, whenever I listen to the news or read what people have to say, it's about cops and robbers. It's about the construction mafia, and it's about extortion. And the thing that worries me most is the solution doesn't seem to be growing up well. I mean, what we're seeing now is increasingly that the cops are shooting the robbers. Okay.
Yes.
And so that doesn't bode well for a structured, you know, escape route from the endemic mindset around corruption. And so I worry that it's a very difficult problem to solve, but it's not solved violence in return for violence. Do you have thoughts on that, Tim?
In a sense, I think violence as a solution, as a theoretical notional solution, it's sort of final act of desperation.
Yeah.
When you have no other option, then you go in with guns blazing.
Yeah.
You know, and I do agree with you, it just makes the situation worse. That's a sort of microcosm in South Africa. In the macrocosm, you can see what's happening in Israel and with Hamas. You know, sort of the same thing. You know, it's very clear that Israel is winning the war, but, you know, it's also storing up problems for itself for centuries. And I don't understand why people don't see that, you know, that writ large, that's the same sort of issue. Or is it? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but you take it to its logical conclusion and you end up back to the Joburg inner city, if you like, or back to the construction mafia.
Yeah.
You end up with a parallel society. You know, you end up with a society that's ruled by the mafia and a society that, you know, has the courts. And it's the final handover when innocent people are being extorted and their family members are being kidnapped and things of that nature. And as you say, as a final resort, we end up shooting each other. So
yeah.
I would welcome a world where we sat down and go, okay, can we look at some of the causes? Can we do a diagnosis here? And can we see whether or not there's a cure? I think I'll write stories about that. Anyway, so I'm worried about that. I'm worried about the fact that it's become common, that it's cops and robbers. And that's not a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. And the South Africa's sort of ongoing lightweight corruption.
Yeah.
I think people don't realize the extent to which lightweight corruption, you know, permits heavyweight corruption.
Exactly.
You know, so there's a big debate about whether or not, you know, that a long time ago, there was this theory that, you know, to fix crime in New York, you had to make sure that all of the smashed windows were fixed. You know what I mean? Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do.
Quite a long time ago, people, you know, argued about whether it was, you know, that was the solution. But I just can't get away from the feeling that things like the VBS scandal, if people see very senior people, the justice minister in this case, taking a loan from VBS, you know, it might have been theoretically all above board, but nevertheless, that kind of suspicious action by very senior people provides the kind of mental space for people in Batuba Tuba to go, you know, well, why can't I? Shouldn't I? Well, if that's the game, you know, what the hell? You know,
these are the origins, these habits become the origins of common law.
Yeah.
You know, to extrapolate a bit beyond. Yes. But pausing on VBS, I mean, the circularity of it is what I want to focus on. I mean, so whether or not the justice minister got a loan is to me not the focal point, because you're perfectly entitled to get a loan to run a business.
Yes.
Okay. The question is, who presided over funding the bank, okay, in the first place?
Yes.
Okay, so where did VBS get its depositors? And then what did it do with the depositors? And was there a feedback circle involved? That's the test for me. And of course, the ultimate test is, well, you know, how do we compensate the innocent?
Yes.
Because, you know, the pensioners and the other people who have lost money there, how do we compensate them? Because they need to be compensated. I think it's an obligation of the state, quite frankly. When a registered bank defaults on its depositors, I think there's a discussion that has to take place about structurally what is permitted and what's not. And you know, looking to the state, I heard the Minister of Health the other day saying that guess who's going to come to fund the NHI? Well, it's going to be the PRC.
Okay. Yes.
And so I go, well, sorry, I didn't see that in the PRC's asset management mandate anywhere, that they are going to bail out government. Okay. I think they've got to invest the funds for the best prosperity of their underlying pensioners in the longer term and so on. And so where did the discussion go about the yield on NHI and the present value of that investment as compared to buying more NVIDIA shares or whatever it is that they wanted to do?
Yes.
And so we're seeing these pools of capital improperly gathered being improperly dispersed in some cases. And that's the root cause that we need to focus on, you know. And so innocent until proven guilty. So I don't want to focus on the minister, but I do want to focus on the notion that you can behave recklessly, particularly if you have influence with other people's money. That's the crime here.
Okay. Yes, yes, yeah. You know, there's quite a lot of financial news sort of happening today.
Yeah.
The Business Day story about Transnet was very interesting. So basically, Transnet has granted a company called International Container Terminal Services, which is a Philippines-based company, the right to develop Durban's second pier, right? The second pier terminal. But now it turns out that actually there was an accounting problem in assessing the solvency of the International Container Terminal Services. And they used their market cap as the basis for their solvency. So, Mark, you know about this. Is that legit or not?
Well, you know, it's deeply worrying that the presiders over such massive state expenditure and contracts do not know the difference between net asset value, which is an on-balance sheet test of solvency, and market capitalization, which is a measure of the value of the shares. These are two distinct concepts, and to believe that your market capitalization is a substitute or even a proxy for your solvency. I mean, for example, you know, you get early stage IT companies that are making fabulous losses, and you know, they're barely solvent, but they are worth fortunes because there's an anticipation of what they're going to earn in the future and so on. And so these two things are completely divorced. Now, what worries me the most is not whether or not there was a bad judgment call here, but whether there was an absence of understanding at all here. We cannot function as an economy, and we certainly can't function as the state unless there is a deep understanding of finance. And the examples of its absence are in abundance. And so, you know, what are you supposed to do when a person awarding contracts doesn't know the difference between NAV and market cap? Come on.
Yes. Yeah,
get
yeah.
someone in the room that does.
Yes. There is a little bit of a suspicion around the story. Or story. I mean, it's not suspicion, but you know, the objection is being raised by a competitive bidder.
Competitor, yeah.
Yeah. So, which is inevitable, right? But, you know, the amounts of money involved here are just really not small. And as it happens, ICTSI's bid was the lower of the two bids. So they bid $550 million.
Yeah.
Not a small amount of money, right?
Yeah.
And the competitor offered over 600. So you know, the competitor, by the way, is the Danish company Møller Mærsk, you know, one of the biggest shipping companies in the world.
I don't know the numbers. I don't know whether this was a fair market value or anything else, but I do have an indication of the incompetence of the judgment. Okay.
Yes.
And so that then puts everything, in my view, into question. Okay, if you don't know that. And here's what worries me: is if in the fullness of time this service provider did go bankrupt, and we said, "How did you guys not figure that?" And they said, "Well, we looked at the market cap," and we all go, "What?"
Yeah.
Okay, it's the same as this guy from Prasa who had, you know, doctorates from here and job offers in Germany and all of these kinds of things. And the obfuscation that was offered by the spokesperson there about how they didn't find that out in the beginning is worrying. And so all of these tests that are put up to qualify for a job or to qualify for a tender or whatever are worthless in the absence of a deep understanding of whether they're real or not. I can remember when I applied for the job at the post office, I was required to produce my original matric certificate, which, strangely enough, I had and knew where it was. But I did say to the department, excuse me, don't you issue these things? Okay, so shouldn't you tell me whether or not I've got a matric?
Right.
We need to circle around and hold hands on sharing that knowledge and deep understanding. Otherwise, we're really operating in a speculative environment.
Staying with the issue of market capitalization, this is the other piece of big financial news this week was about the JSE's restructuring. Basically, what's happening is the JSE is splitting itself into two, a sort of like bigger half and, you know, a half with bigger companies and a half with smaller companies. And the smaller companies are getting less red tape. And yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think that's great. It's an indication in a broader sense of a kind of, you know, concern from the corporate world everywhere about the enormous amount of restrictions that are being placed on them. I'm not really instinctively sympathetic to this sort of idea, but when you see what they have to do, you know, I mean, I remember one person in government saying he was working for a government institution that had to required to bring out an annual report with, you know, enormous details in it. And he said, you know, I'm bringing this report out for two people because there's only two people who are going to read this.
Yeah. It's not a simple discussion. I'll tell you why. I mean, I on balance, anything that can, you know, make easier and more resilient and open up the capital raising capacity of our country and the smaller businesses, I'm basically for. However, the reason that these regulations persist is a little bit like the logic that underpins having a banking license or a banking regulator, should I say, which is that retail investors who are perhaps less informed than financial asset managers or, you know, whichever class of financial expertise you'd like to refer to, do need some comfort, do need some assurance that some basic tests are being passed. So the answer lies in the balance. I mean, make it easier, but not to the point where you don't have some degree of reliance, which you do have, unless you go buyer beware, and then you don't have to have any rules, okay? But these rules have, as their foundation, been formulated on the back of, you know, unhappy experiences about knowledge dissemination and things of that nature. So there's a balance. I'm with you that let's make it easier, but let's also then operate in a world which says if you retailers and you small investors want to get easier access to them, then you must also grow up a bit. Okay, then you must also accept it's true. You know, can't say I'm fully protected and I want upside only and no red tape. There's a balance, and I hope it works because we desperately need it. But when it goes into the listed space, it's kind of got, you know, I guess it's been washed through the regulatory system and investors can go with more confidence. So let's hope it works. I'm supporting.
It is incredible in general terms, the decline in number of listings in South Africa. So really, I mean, I've been writing about this. I bore myself with my own argument. It is shocking to me. This is, you know, really one of the leading exchanges in the world. And we've gone from 600 companies to 250. I mean, it's just incredible. And that is all about red tape, but it's all about the state of the economy in general, because about the prospects for growth. Because, you know, companies list because they think they're going to grow and they need access to capital, and that just gives them an option. So if they're not going to grow, then why be listed?
Why we listed is a big debate. And I think this whole question doesn't get answered unless you go into the other ways of investment, which are, you know, private investment in companies or private equity. And perhaps most importantly, the informal economy. How do those capital flows work? You know, they don't pay tax, but there's a thriving informal economy, which if we found the right mix between listed, private investment and informal economy, we would have a mixture which should satisfy the investment desires of the, you know, broad population, I would have thought. And so if this is a step towards that, I'm kind of for it. Okay.
No.
Anyway, Tim, how much of your personal identifying data, like your fingerprint or your eye, what do you call it? What is your eye?
Your iris.
Or your palm of your hand or your face, are you prepared to give up in the name of convenience? Okay. So for example, now, I sign onto my phone because I've got face recognition, and I go into the parking lot because there's a sort of palm recognition. When I go, there's a car recognition. And so this data is all going somewhere. Okay.
Good.
And it's all contributing towards access to my personal life, which is, you know, I have to say, infiltrated by more marketing calls and other inquiries and potential, you know, scams, which have evidenced deep knowledge about who I am and what I do. And you know, if I do something on my phone, say I've got a sore toe, I mean, try it, Tim. Just go, my toe is very sore, and watch. Within days, you'll have toe remedy solutions flying into your phone unsolicited. You know, I made a comment the other day about my golf swing to a mate, okay? And I promise you, not in the places that I follow, but in a thing called For You, I'm now getting golf lessons every half an hour. And so where's the line? What do you think?
I don't know. You know, it's one of those terrible short-term, long-term decisions, because in the short term, I'm very happy to give up quite a lot of my sort of personal information, if you want to call it that, you know, my fingerprints and my sort of face prints to make things easier. But then in the longer term, you sort of worry about it. And I'll tell you why. I got a phone call recently from a scammer trying to kind of scam money out of my account. Yeah. Right. And the reason I didn't hang up immediately was because they were able to put on the table a whole bunch of personal information about me and where I bank and what my bank account says and all of that sort of stuff, you know. And if they weren't able to do that, you know, they would have never got me past 5 seconds. But actually, as it happens, they got pretty close to scamming my entire account. You know, it was just really at the last phase of the whole process, I realized, hang on, this can't be right.
It's moved from phishing to what they now call spear phishing. Okay, they've got you. But it's not like they've got a net, they've got a spear, okay?
They know
stuff about you that you go, okay, this. And we don't vet them. I know when I phone the bank, got my money, they're now at great pains to identify me, okay? I mean, to the point that I get exasperated with the fact that, but they never worry about identifying themselves. I go, who are you? And they go, I'm Joe and I work at the bank. I said, how do I know that?
Exactly. The topic that I wanted to talk about was I've got a great number. And by great number, when I say great number, it's a number that you will never guess.
I'm going to start this game. Yeah. I'm going to start this with trillion. What about trillion?
Okay. The question is, which countries gained the most wealth since 2010? So basically, we're talking about 14 years, 15 years.
Per capita or in absolute terms?
No, per capita. So how much wealthier have people become on average in a country over the past 15 years? Okay. So which country wins that race?
I don't know. I'm going to go for one of those overcrowded tourist destinations. Greece.
No, the answer is Kazakhstan, which is, I thought it was really incredible. I mean, who knew? None of us knew. So this is all according to the UBS. The Swiss bank brings out something called a wealth report every year. And somebody's taken all of these reports and come up with a sort of data set. Mm. And you'd be happy to know, so that's the one thing, but how much richer have people become? And the answer is 190% in Kazakhstan.
Over 14 years.
15 years, yeah. So this is 9% a year, basically, is the top performing country around the world.
I was going to say, doubling every 15 years is...
Second is China.
China per capita. That's astonishing.
Yeah. Exactly. It's 8% per year for the past 14 years in wealth. So that's 185% up.
Okay, Tim, give me the news. Where do we sit on this?
Well, we're up, actually, strangely enough. So we're up 30%, but that puts us really in the lowest quartile of countries around the world.
What's that? 2% per annum or something?
Yeah, just a little bit more, actually. But anyway.
Less than.
Yeah. But we can be delighted in the fact that we have grown faster than Belgium and also France. But, you know, they were richer than us in the first place.
It's about bloody time too, you know. Have a nice day.
Anyway, but don't you find it interesting that like a whole range of countries, you know, that are really growing incredibly fast. Wealth around the world really is increasing incredibly fast.
Quietly getting on with it. Well, good for them.
Yeah, and countries that don't necessarily just sort of jump to mind. Thailand, you know, almost 80% up. So, you know, 5% a year over 15 years. That's a serious money. Qatar, India, the spread of wealth around the world really is just extraordinary. It's just amazing.
Well, that's another subject on its own. I wonder what the spread of wealth is like in those destinations, but talking about numbers.
Yeah.
Do you know what my number is of the week? Because we're not allowed to talk sport or weather here anymore.
Okay.
Here's my number. And I'm going to leave it for everyone to work out what it is. But it's 67-27. Okay. That's what it is. 67-27. You figure it out, guys. Have a nice week.
Okay. Cheers, Mark. Look after yourself.